lobby.
Christ, Decker, are you just getting in?
She said, eyeing his grungy, wet clothes.
Good morning to you, too. Would you like to get some breakfast?
She followed him into the dining area off the lobby. They sat, ordered some food, and sipped their coffees.
So?
Said Jameson.
Was Susan Richards any help?
She didn't cop to the murder, if that's what you're asking. She doesn't have a solid alibi. She was home asleep, she says.
Well, considering the hour, that makes sense.
We may be able to tighten the parameters on that by talking to her neighbors, but I don't think she's good for it. She says she didn't even know he was back in town, and that seems perfectly logical.
Unless she saw him on the street.
I saw him and didn't recognize him, said Decker. And I spent a lot of time with the guy all those years ago.
Have you called Bogart and gotten his permission to work on this?
He said quietly.
We've, talked. I'm surprised he hasn't called you.
No, he didn't. So what did he say?
At that moment, their food arrived. Decker said,
I'll fill you in later.
Thank you for ordering a veggie omelet, by the way,
said Jameson.
And avoiding the bacon.
You must be growing on me.
Well, I'm just happy that you're not growing anymore. You look good, Decker.
Well, that's a stretch, but thanks.
He put his knife and fork down and finished his coffee.
What are you thinking?
Asked Jameson.
I'm thinking that there's a killer walking around town this morning, thinking that he or she got away with murder, and it's really pissing me off.
Is that all?
He looked at her curiously.
Isn't that enough?
I mean, do you feel guilty about what happened to Merrill Hawkins?
I didn't pull the trigger on the guy. I didn't ask him to come here and ignite this case again.
But you think that the fact that someone killed him is evidence that he might have been innocent? I mean, you basically said that earlier.
Meaning that I made a mistake? Said Decker slowly.
I wouldn't look at it that way. You investigated the case and all the evidence pointed to that guy. I would have seen it the same way.
Regardless, if he was innocent, I have to make it right.
Jameson hiked her eyebrows.
Because the weight of the world's problems always falls on your admittedly broad shoulders?
Not the weight of the world. The weight of one case that I handled. Responsibility comes with the territory. My actions took a guy's freedom away.
No, I'd say his actions took his freedom away.
Only if he did it, countered Decker. If he didn't commit the crimes, it's a whole other ballgame.
Jameson fingered her coffee cup.
If he was set up, whoever did it knew what they were doing. Who would have a beef against the guy that badly?
Decker nodded.
Good point, and I have no idea. Hawkins was a skilled machinist, but lost his job when the factory he worked at had layoffs. Then he went on the odd job road, doing what he could to make ends meet.
Sounds like a lot of people these days.
He eyed the FBI badge that was clipped to her lapel.
How does it feel?
She looked down at the badge and smiled.
Pretty damn good, actually. Did you ever think of taking the plunge?
I'm too old now. Age 37 is the cutoff, and I'm not a military veteran, so I can't seek that waiver. And even if I could still apply, I doubt I'd pass the physical.
Don't underestimate yourself. And since you know the requirements, I take it you looked into it?
Decker shrugged.
I can do my job without the federal badge. I'm still a sworn police officer. I can arrest people.
He paused and added,
And you always have my back.
Yes, I do.
I went by my old house early this morning.
She looked startled by this admission.
Why?
I don't know. My feet pointed that way and suddenly I was there. Met the dad who lives there and saw his little girl. Lancaster had told me about them. I spooked them a little showing up like that, but the dad had heard about what had happened. There. It turned out okay.
Jameson leaned forward.
I know that you don't want to hear this, Decker, but I'm going to say it anyway.
She paused, seeming to choose her words with great care.
At some point, you're going to have to let this go. I mean, I get coming back here to visit their graves and all, but you have your life left to live. That means you have to move forward and stop dwelling in the past so much. Cassie and Molly wouldn't want you to do that. You know that.
Do I? Said Decker abruptly. She sat back, looking saddened by this comment. They shouldn't be dead, Alex. If anyone should be dead, it should be me.
But you're not. You're alive, and you have to spend every day living for them and yourself. Otherwise, it's all wasted.
Decker rose. I'm going to take a shower and change my clothes, and then we're going to go catch a killer. I'll meet you back down here in half an hour.
Decker, you need to get some sleep.
No, that would just be wasting time, wouldn't it?
As he walked off, Jameson just stared after him, the look on her face one of heartbreak. Chapter 7. Decker let the hot water run off his head for a full minute before soaping up. The next moment, he had a brief panic attack because he couldn't recall Cassie's favorite color. Then his memory righted itself and the proper shade kicked out of his brain. He rested his head against the shower tile.
Shit, more hiccups. No, more malfunctions, because I'm a machine after all, right?
Was his memory going to keep misfiring, right when he needed it to work precisely? Or would there be a time when it simply stopped functioning altogether? Then a dreaded thought sprouted up. Was he developing complications from his brain injury all those years ago, like CTE? He finished in the shower, dried off, and put on fresh clothes. Mentally, he still felt like crap, and physically he was tired, but at least he was clean. Jameson was waiting for him in the lobby. They got into the car, and from the driver's seat, Jameson said,
Where to?
Our only viable suspect right now, Susan Richards.
On the way, he phoned Lancaster and told her what they were going to do. He had to leave a message because the call went to voicemail. She was probably still sleeping, surmised Decker. Richards's home on Primrose Avenue was a small, single-story brick bungalow with old-fashioned green and white striped metal awnings over the windows. The patch of yard was neatly laid out, with mature trees and well-shaped bushes and planting beds. An abundance of colorful fall flowers was displayed in pots on the covered front stoop.
Nice landscaping,
commented Jameson.
She was a florist for years, explained Decker. Into gardening. Runs the floral shop she sold to new owners a while back.
Do you actually think she could have murdered Hawkins last night?
She could have, but I don't know if she did. That's what we have to find out.
They got out, but Decker didn't head up to the front door. He instead walked over to the house across the street.
Verifying alibis?
Said Jameson as she caught up to him. He nodded and knocked on the door of the bungalow that was a twin of Richards's home, only with a screened-in porch on one end. Answering the door was a tiny elderly woman with white hair so thin they could see her reddened scalp underneath.
Yes,
she said, staring at them from behind thick glasses. Jameson held out her FBI badge, which the woman scrutinized.
FBI,
she said.
Have I done something wrong?
No,
said Jameson hastily.
We were checking on a neighbor of yours, Ms.
Agatha Bates.
She looked up at the towering Decker.
Are you FBI? You didn't show me a badge.
She ran her gaze over him.
You look too big to be FBI. I watch a lot of TV. No FBI agent is as big as you.
Jameson said hastily.
He works as a consultant for us.
Bates slowly drew her gaze from Decker and settled it on Jameson.
Which neighbor?
Susan Richards?
Oh, Susan, sure. Nice lady. Lived here a while. Not nearly so long as me. I've been here 57 years.
She looked at Decker again.
Don't I know you?
I worked here on the police force for 20 years.
Oh, well, I don't have much contact with the police. I pay my taxes, and I've never robbed anybody.
I'm sure,
said Jameson.
We were wondering if you could tell us when you last saw Ms. Richards.
Well, I saw her this morning when the police came to get her. We don't usually have the police around here.
That was pretty early,
noted Jameson.
Well, I get up pretty early. Only sleep maybe 4 hours a night. You get old, you don't sleep. I'll be sleeping all the time pretty soon.
Excuse me?
Said Jameson.
When I die, honey, I'm 93. How much longer do you expect me to be around?
She paused and adjusted her glasses.
So, why did the police take her in the first place?
For some questions. Did you see her yesterday in the evening, maybe?
I saw her come home. It was around 8:15.
How can you be so certain? Asked Decker. And have you spoken to her this morning?
No, I haven't talked to her. She's home now. She hasn't come out of her house. Least that I saw. Usually takes a walk in the morning. I have my coffee on the screen porch. I wave, she waves back. I guess the police come and mess that up.
So you didn't see her come back from the police station this morning? Asked Decker.
No, I was probably in the kitchen making breakfast or out in the backyard, puttering. I like to putter. People my age, we putter, and we do it slow. I don't need a broken hip.
So, last night?
Prompted Jameson.
8:15,
she said again, staring at Decker.
She volunteers at the homeless shelter. She always gets in around that time. And I know the time because Jeopardy had been over about 15 minutes. I got the final Jeopardy question. The answer was Harry Truman. I remember Truman. Hell, I voted for him. All three of the contestants got it wrong. Not a single one was over 30. What do they know about Harry Truman? I would have won enough to take a vacation somewhere.
So you saw her come home last night? Did she leave again? Would you have seen her if she did?
She didn't drive in her car if she did,
said Bates.
That car of hers sounds like a bomb going off when she starts it up. It's an old Honda, darn muffler shot. Told her to get it fixed. Almost makes me wet my pants every time I hear it. My hearing's still good. I can hear pretty much everything, and especially that damn car.
But she could have left another way. Walked or called a cab?
Well, I was out on the screen porch doing the crosswords and reading until about 10:30 or so. I would have seen her leave. After that, I went inside. Hit the hay about 11 or so.
Okay, to be clear, at least until 10:30 or so, she hadn't left her house, said Decker. And you never heard the car start up, at least until you went to bed around 11?
I thought I just said that. Are you slow?
That's great, said Jameson quickly. Mrs. Bates, you've been very helpful.
Okay. Glad to do my civic duty.
She jerked her thumb at Decker and said in a low voice to Jameson,
I think the FBI needs better consultants, but you keep doing what you're doing, honey. Nice to see you, gal, agent.
Thanks,
said Jameson, trying hard to suppress a smile. They left Bates and headed back to the street. Decker said,
If Richards walked, she could have gotten to the Residence Inn in time to kill Hawkins. And she clearly could have if she took a cab.
If she took a cab, we'll be able to find record of it. I suppose they don't have Uber here?
No, I don't think so.
They tried the other two homes, but no one answered their knocks.
Bottom line is, we haven't eliminated Richards as a suspect for Hawkins' murder, noted Decker.
But do you really think she might have done it?
She has the most direct motive, but there are a lot of obstacles in the way. How would she know he was back in town, being foremost among them?
You don't think he would have gone to see her?
How would Hawkins even know where she lived? Hank Astor didn't tell him. I know that. And if he was innocent of the murders, he wouldn't have gone there to apologize.
You can Google someone's address easily enough,
said Jameson.
He just got out of prison and was terminally ill. I'm not sure I see the guy walking around with a computer and an internet connection, or finding one all that easily.
But he might have gone to get some info from her, especially if he thought she did it.
Decker shook his head.
No, Hawkins knew from the trial that she had a firm alibi. He paused and added thoughtfully, theoretically, she could have hired someone to do it for her, though there was absolutely no evidence of that. But we still arrive back at the problem with motive. With her husband around, she could stay home and raise the kids. She never got remarried. There was no boyfriend waiting in the wings. She didn't get rich off her family's murders. I just don't see it. And no way she was going to kill her own kids.
I agree,
admitted Jameson.
There's one guy we can talk to who might be able to tell us more.
Who's that?
Ken Finger.
Ken Finger? How does he figure into this?
He was Hawkins's public defender.
Is he still around?
Let's go find out.
Chapter 8. Ken Finger was indeed still around. Decker had finally reached Lancaster, and she arranged to meet them at Finger's office, which was located a block over from the downtown courthouse. His secretary, Christine Berlin, a woman in her mid-40s, met their request with a stern look.
Mr. Finger is very busy at present,
she said when confronted with Decker, Jameson, and Lancaster. Lancaster took out her badge.
I think Ken can make some time for this.
Berlin stared at the badge far longer than was needed.
Come on, Christine,
said an exasperated Lancaster.
It's not like you don't know who I am. Some of your kids go to the same school as Sandy, and you know Decker as well from working with Ken.
Well, I try to maintain a professional atmosphere at work, Detective Lancaster.
I'm all for professional, said Decker. So where's Ken?
Berlin looked up at him.
I heard you were back in town for a few days,
she said.
You still working for the FBI?
Decker nodded and she looked at Jameson.
I remember you, too. I take it you're still consulting with the Bureau?
I'm actually a special agent now,
said Jameson.
That's a strange career change from journalist to FBI agent.
Not that strange,
replied Jameson.
Why?
An FBI agent looks to find the truth and make sure the right people are punished. A journalist digs to find the truth and make sure the public knows about it. And that sometimes leads to bad people being punished.
Said Berlin, looking skeptical of this.
I guess that could be.
Where's Ken? Said Decker impatiently. We're wasting crucial time here.
Berlin frowned.
I see that you haven't changed one bit.
She picked up her desk phone and made the call. A few moments later, she escorted them into Finger's office. It was large with ample windows. His desk was constructed of dark wood with a leather top. It was strewn with books, legal pads, files, and stapled pleadings. A large bookshelf held old law books and red file folders neatly labeled. There were chairs set around a coffee table. A credenza against one wall was set up as a bar and also held two large glass jars of M&Ms. Ken Finger sat behind his desk. Finger had only been about 30 when he had defended Hawkins against a capital murder charge. There apparently had been no other takers who wanted to defend in court the man charged with brutally murdering two men and two kids. He was now in his 40s and worked as a defense attorney for those who needed it. And in Burlington, like most towns, there were a great many who needed his services. His tidy brown hair was turning gray, as was his trim beard. His pleated trousers were held up by bright red braces, and his white shirt had French cuffs. His striped bow tie was undone, and hung limply around his waddled neck. His belly stuck out from between the braces. He rose and greeted them, motioning them over to the seating area around the coffee table. "I guess I know why you're here," he said, after Berlin closed the door behind her.
"Guess you do,"
replied Lancaster.
"How the hell are you, Decker?"
Finger said.
"Okay," said Decker as he sat down. "So you've heard."
"How could I not? Burlington's not that big, and although it's not like the attack on the high school when you lived here, it's still newsworthy when a convicted murderer comes back to town and then gets murdered."
Lancaster said.
"Had he come to see you?"
Finger shook his head. "Hadn't seen hide nor hair of him since he went to prison."
"You never visited him there?"
asked Jameson. "Well, I take that back. I did go visit him there because we filed an appeal, but it was turned down flat. I mean, we didn't really have any grounds for an appeal. If anything, the judge went out of his way to accommodate us, and the jury could have returned a death sentence, but they didn't. I actually told Merrill that his escaping the death penalty was the best he could expect. Why make waves?"
"Were you convinced of his guilt?"
asked Lancaster. Finger shrugged. "It didn't matter to me one way or another. My job is to defend. It's the state's job to prove guilt. I live in the creases of reasonable doubt. All defense lawyers do."
"But did you think he was guilty?" persisted Decker.
Finger sat back and steepled his hands. "You know that the attorney-client privilege survives the death of a client."
"I'm not asking for you to reveal any privileged communications," Decker pointed out. "I'm just asking your opinion on the matter. That's not privileged and can in no way injure your client. He was already convicted, and now he's dead."
Finger grinned. "You would have made a good lawyer, Decker." "Okay, yeah, I thought he'd done it. I think he went over there just to steal some stuff and ran into a whole lot of trouble that he couldn't handle. It wasn't like the guy was a career criminal. Hell, he hadn't had so much as a parking ticket. I think that was one reason he didn't get the death penalty. I think he lost it and started shooting and strangling, and before he knew it, he had 4 dead bodies. Then he just got the hell out of there."
"And no one saw him drive up, enter the place, and then leave, or hear the shots," said Decker.
Finger shrugged. "Who knows? People said they heard nothing. One house was playing loud music, and the other, the folks said they were watching TV or sleeping. The third house, the people weren't home that night, and the fourth house was abandoned. And the houses weren't that close. And then there was the noise from the storm."
He gave Decker a funny look.
"Hell, Amos, you and Mary are the ones that made the case against him. Prints, DNA, motive, opportunity, and the murder weapon found hidden in his home. I mean, as a defense lawyer, I had nothing really to work with. I considered it a miracle he only got life without parole."
"And the stolen goods?"
said Lancaster. "Hawkins didn't have an explanation for that because he said he didn't commit the crime. But if you want my opinion, I think he chucked it all when he knew he couldn't fence them without it tying him to 4 homicides."
Decker shook his head. "He had $500 in his wallet the night he was picked up."
"And the prosecution suggested that was the proceeds from his fencing, the stolen goods. But the stuff that he was supposed to have stolen would have fetched more money than that, I think."
"And you postulated a theory that Hawkins was planning to use the $500 to purchase painkillers for his wife, Lisa, off the street. Did he tell you that, or did you just come up with it?"
"Hey, I don't just come up with stuff, Decker," Finger said firmly. "That's what he told me."
"So where'd he get the money?"
asked Lancaster. "He never said."
"I wonder why," said Decker. "I mean, if he could have come up with a viable explanation, that would have taken a big chunk out of the prosecution's case."
"Believe me, I tried, but he wouldn't say."
Lancaster said,
"He'd gotten laid off from his job a while back. They had no money."
"I'm just telling you what he told me about it, which was zip, and I wouldn't let him take the stand, so the prosecution was able to bring out the money during the trial. I tried to poke holes at it and brought him up wanting to buy drugs for his terminally ill wife to get some sympathy in the courtroom, but I could tell the jury wasn't buying it. They were connecting the dots on the money and the stolen goods, There was no way around that. And for all I know, the $500 did come from that. Who's to say what a fence will pay for hot goods connected to a string of murders? And there was no way a fence would have come forward and gotten involved in the case. So there was no avenue for me to investigate unless Merrill opened up about it, which he never did. Lancaster said,
But more to the point, why would he go to a house that early in the evening and that was full of people?
Decker interjected. There were no cars out front. David Katz's car was parked in the back of the house, and Hawkins wouldn't have been able to see that if he approached from the front, which he had to. The Richardses only had one car at the time. The wife had taken it. The other car was in for repairs.
But there were lights on when the first responders got there,
countered Lancaster.
Pretty stupid burglar to hit a house all lit up.
Finger spread his hands.
What can I tell you? That's what happened. Like I said, the guy wasn't an experienced criminal, and he had no alibi. You know that.
Decker said,
And Hawkins might have thought the lights were on just because of the storm. With no cars out front, and the house didn't have a garage, he might have thought it was empty.
Finger added,
And if he didn't do it, someone went to a lot of trouble to frame him. Why would they? He was a nobody, blue-collar guy his whole life. I'm not saying that's bad. Hell, I admired him for that. My old man was a mechanic, could do stuff I never could. I'm just saying Merrill was a regular guy with a regular life. Not worth the trouble.
And yet somebody went to the trouble of killing him, said Decker. And his life wasn't exactly regular. His wife was dying, and his daughter was a drug addict.
That's true. Hey, did you check with Susan? She's still around.
Gee, why didn't we think of that?
Said Lancaster.
So you don't think she's good for it? Said Finger.
What I think about an active police investigation is none of your business, Ken.
Finger smiled. Come on, Mary. I thought we were friends.
We're also professional adversaries because I have to testify in court to put away your guilty clients, and you do your best to discredit my truthful testimony.
Hey, it's called cross-examination. We don't have many arrows in our quiver, but that's one of the prime ones, and the state has all the resources. I'm just one guy.
Keep telling yourself that. It's a good day when the internet works at the police station. My computer's about 15 years old, and I haven't had a raise in 8 years.
He smiled impishly.
You can always come over to our side. Be an expert witness. Pays pretty well.
She returned the look.
Thanks, but no thanks. I have a hard enough time sleeping as it is.
I sleep like a baby, retorted Finger, grinning.
Decker looked over at the bookshelf where a bunch of files were stacked.
We need to see your records on the case.
Why?
Because there might be a clue in there as to who killed Hawkins.
The privilege still applies, Decker.
Decker looked at the man.
Hawkins came to me and asked me to prove his innocence. He did the same to Mary.
Finger glanced sharply at Lancaster, who nodded.
That was the only reason he was back in town. To tell me and Decker that we got it wrong, and he wanted us to make it right. We went to the Residence Inn to meet with him to go over that. That's when we found him dead.
Decker said,
So it seems to me that by his words and actions, Hawkins has waived his privilege, because how else can we prove his innocence if we can't look at your files?
Finger sighed.
Well, you make a compelling argument, I'll give you that. And I guess it couldn't hurt at this point, but it's been a long time. You think I still have that stuff?
Most attorneys I know never throw anything away, replied Decker firmly.
So you're thinking he's innocent now, after all this time?
Some people here thought I'd killed my family, said Decker.
I wasn't one of them, said Finger quickly.
Decker rose.
So let's go get those files.
What, you mean now? They're in storage, probably.
Yeah, now.
But I've got to be in court in 20 minutes.
Then I'm sure your secretary can help us. Now.
What's your rush?
After all these years, I'm not waiting on the truth 1 second longer than I have to.
replied Decker. Chapter 9.
It's over here.
They were in a climate-controlled storage unit. After consulting the iPad she was holding, Christine Berlin pointed to a shelf in the far back of the space.
You seem very well organized,
said Lancaster appreciatively.
Well, of course I am. Mr. Finger is not the best in that regard, so I have to make up for it, and I can assure you that I do.
Lancaster whispered to Jameson.
She has 4 kids. The oldest is in 8th grade, and I think she still dresses them in garanimals.
There were only 2 boxes dealing with the case, Berlin told them. She made Lancaster sign an electronic receipt before she would allow them to take the containers. They trudged back to their cars with Decker schlepping both boxes. Lancaster said,
You can take them back to the station. Captain Miller has arranged a room for you to use.
How is Captain Miller? Said Decker.
Ready to retire,
said Lancaster.
But aren't we all? I'll meet you back there later.
Wait a minute. Where are you going? Asked Decker.
I have other cases to work,
she said incredulously.
And this one is not officially on my plate or even a case for the department.
But Hawkins's murder is.
And we don't know if it's connected to what's in those files, so you go through them and let me know what you find out, if anything. And let me go about trying to solve some new crimes like Hawkins's murder.
She got into her car and drove off. When Decker didn't climb into their rental, Jameson paused, her hand on the car door.
What's up?
That's what I want to know. What's up with Mary?
What do you mean?
I've known her a long time. She's not telling me something.
Well, she has that right, Decker. But she might come around. And it's nice that you're worried about your old partner,
she added. They drove to the police station and were directed to the room reserved for their use. As they were heading down the hall, a man in his early 60s stepped out of an office. Captain Mackenzie Miller was still short, wide, and puffy, with an unhealthy tint to his skin. But his smile was broad and infectious.
Look what they let in the door, he said.
He put out his hand for Decker to shake. He nodded at Jameson and shook her hand, too, then pointed to the badge on her jacket.
I heard. Congrats, Alex. I know that wasn't easy.
Thanks, Mac.
Decker eyed the man who had been his superior his entire time on the police force. Miller was a good cop, tough, fair, and he didn't bullshit. He had actually stopped Decker from putting a bullet in his brain once. It would be impossible to dislike the man after that.
Well, you've been establishing quite a rep for yourself at the Bureau. Ross Bogart keeps me updated.
Didn't know that, said Decker, the boxes pressed against his wide chest.
Nice to know there are some things you don't know, said Miller. He eyed the boxes. Lawyer's files? Hawkins?
Yes,
responded Jameson.
Well, I'll let you get to it, then. It's good to see you both. Let's grab a beer later, if you're able.
Decker said,
Can I ask a question?
Would it matter if I said no?
What's going on with Mary?
Miller folded his short arms over his thick chest.
Why do you think anything's going on with her, Amos?
We know each other. Something's off.
You knew each other. It's been a couple of years. People change.
People don't change that much, replied Decker.
Then ask her. Miller wagged a finger at him. Just be prepared for whatever answer she has.
You up for that?
Decker didn't answer, and Miller didn't look like he had expected a response.
I appreciate you letting us work on the case.
Well, I want to get to the bottom of it as much as you do. If we messed up, we have to make it right. You have my full backing.
Thanks, Mac,
said Jameson.
I'll leave you to it, then.
He disappeared back inside his office. They proceeded to the room, and Decker put the twin boxes down on the metal conference table. He took off his coat and slung it over a chair back. Taking the top off one box, he said to Jameson,
I'll take this one. You go through the other.
He slid it over to her.
What exactly are we looking for?
she asked, opening the box.
Hopefully you'll know it when you see it.
She sighed, sat down, and lifted out the first few files. 4 hours later, they had each gone through both boxes.
Not a whole lot here,
noted Jameson.
This is the defense's side of things. I've asked Mary to have someone pull the department's files.
They keep things that long?
Probably only because nobody had the time to throw them out.
Ken Finger didn't seem to have much evidence to go on.
That's why the jury convicted his client after only 2 hours of deliberation, and an hour of that was spent at lunch.
He was pretty tough on you on cross-examination,
said Jameson, holding up a transcript of Decker's time in the witness box.
That was his job.
But you were quite firm in your statements.
Because I believed them to be true.
Meaning you no longer do?
Decker looked at her over a piece of paper he was holding.
Meaning back then I didn't necessarily see the forest for the trees.
Meaning
I might have been so eager to get a conviction on my first homicide investigation that it didn't strike me as odd that a guy would burgle a house that early in the evening when it might be full of people.
Well, maybe he wasn't that smart. As has been pointed out, he wasn't an experienced criminal. Maybe he didn't know how to properly case a target.
Hawkins wasn't dumb. And the thing is, he had never been in any sort of trouble with the law before. That didn't mean much to me back then, because the forensics were overwhelming. But to go from never having a parking ticket to 4 homicides is like going from hopping over a rain puddle to leaping across the Grand Canyon. It should have set off warning bells.
But like everyone's been saying, he probably didn't go in there thinking he was going to kill anyone. Then it just went sideways.
Granted, he was desperate. His wife needed pain medicine. His daughter was a drug addict he was trying to help. He might have felt he was up against a wall. He went there just to steal, and, like you said, everything might have gone to hell after that.
And he had the cash in his pocket.
So if he had the money, why was he still wandering around when he was picked up by the cops?
Maybe he was trying to score the drugs to help his wife.
Maybe, said Decker. But the thing is, there was a house next to the Richardses that was empty that night. I'm not talking about the uninhabited one. I mean the Balmers. They were out of town visiting relatives. Why not go there instead and break in and steal stuff and avoid having to murder 4 people? And why did he pick that neighborhood of all places? It was a long way from where he lived.
It was also isolated.
I don't think that's a good enough reason.
The guy who lived there was a banker. Maybe in Hawkins' mind, that meant there would be valuable stuff to steal?
I think that's a stretch. By no means was that the rich part of town. If you're a burglar, you don't go to Skid Row to do your business. You go where the money is.
Well, rich people have security systems and extra locks and gates and sometimes private guards, too. An area like where the Richardses lived might be more vulnerable.
He shook his head.
It doesn't make sense, Alex. Something is off.
So despite your previous skepticism, now you're saying that you believe Hawkins to be innocent?
No, I'm just trying to get to the truth.
He rose.
I'm going to check on the police files. You want some vending machine coffee? It sucks, but it's hot.
Sure.
Decker walked out and down the hall. 2 cops and 1 detective he'd worked with greeted him as he passed by. They didn't look happy to see him here, and he could understand why. Word had gotten around. If Hawkins had been wrongly convicted, it would be a slap in the face to the whole department.
It'll be a punch in the gut to me, my first real homicide. Did I want it too bad? And did I screw over Merrill Hawkins to get there?
He was so preoccupied with his thoughts that he almost bumped into her. Sally Brimmer hadn't changed very much. Early 30s, pretty, efficient looking. And as he thought before, the woman's slacks were still a little too tight, and too many buttons on her blouse were undone, exhibiting enough cleavage to be intentionally suggestive. She was in public affairs at the police department. Decker had scammed her once, pretending to be an attorney to get a look-see at a prisoner being held here. That had placed her in a bad light with Captain Miller, among others. Decker had taken full responsibility for what he'd done and tried to make sure she was held blameless. However, by the put-out look on her face at seeing him, his actions had not been enough to soothe her harsh feelings for him.
"Ms. Brimmer," said Decker amiably.
Her hands were on her slim hips and a pouty look was perched on her lips.
"I heard you were back. I hoped it was just a rumor that would turn out not to be true."
Okay. Nice to see you, too.
"What are you doing here?"
"Working a case, and I need some department files. I thought I'd have them by now."
"You don't even work here anymore."
"I'm working with Mary Lancaster on a case. Captain Miller authorized it."
"You're not bullshitting me again,"
she said defiantly.
"Actually, it's the truth."
"Right. Fool me once."
"Agent Decker, do you want these in the small conference room?" They looked over to see a young uniformed officer wheeling a hand truck down the hall, on which were stacked four large storage boxes.
"Yeah, thanks. My partner's in there now. I'm just on a coffee run."
Brimmer watched incredulously as the man headed down the hall to the conference room.
"So you weren't bullshitting me. Which case?"
"Merrill Hawkins."
"Don't remember it."
"Way before your time."
"Wait a minute. Wasn't that the guy who was just murdered?"
"Yep."
"But that's a current case."
"It is. The reason he was murdered probably goes back to four homicides that took place about 13 years ago."
"How do you know that?"
"Because I was one who investigated it."
"Four homicides? Who was the killer?"
"Well, that's the question, isn't it?"
He walked on in search of coffee and found it in the break room. Instead of vending machines, however, they had a Keurig. Times did change, and incremental progress was made. Decker prepared two coffees and was about to head back when his attention was caught by something on the TV that was bolted to the wall of the break room. It was a local station, and the weather report was just now coming on. The forecast was for late afternoon storms. As soon as Decker heard that, something clicked in his head. Rain. Chapter 10.
"What are we doing here, Decker?"
asked Jameson.
"You never said,"
she added under her breath.
"As usual."
Decker didn't appear to have heard her. He was staring at various spots in the living room of the Richards' old home, particularly the floor. In his mind, he dialed back to that night and laid what was there on top of what he was seeing right now. And they tallied pretty much exactly.
Rain.
"What?"
said Jameson, looking confused.
"It rained the night of the murders at the Richards' home. Bucketed down. Started at around 6:15 and continued until after Lancaster and I got there. It was a whopper of a storm. Lots of thunder and lightning."
"Yeah, his lawyer mentioned that. So what?"
Decker pointed to the floor.
"There were no wet footprints inside the house other than those of the first responders. No traces of mud or gravel. And Mary and I and the techs put on booties."
"So how could the killer, who clearly came after the rain was pouring down, have not left any wet marks on the floor or carpet?"
She paused.
"Wait a minute. You didn't think of this until now?"
Decker's eyes kept roaming the room.
"Decker, I asked you—"
"I know what you asked, Alex," he said heatedly.
She stiffened at his harsh words. Not meaning her gaze, Decker said,
"I found the print and the blood trace on the wall switch in the living room. It's where someone would put their hand if they were going to hit the light. We had the tech lift it. We ran the print through the databases, and Hawkins's name got kicked out."
"Why was he in the system? Fingers files didn't say. You said he'd never been in trouble with the law before."
"His old job was with a company connected to a defense contractor. He'd had to pass a background check and have his prints on file because of his employment there."
"So from that point on?"
"Hawkins was our prime, well, really only, suspect."
How long did all that take?
We got the idea on the print around 1 in the morning. We immediately went looking for Hawkins after getting his address. He wasn't home when we got there, but his wife and daughter were. They had no idea where he was.
Where did you find him?
We put out a bolo, and a patrol car spotted him a couple hours later walking down a street over on the east side of town. They arrested him and brought him into the station on suspicion of murder. Lancaster and I met him there.
Walking? Didn't he have a car?
An old clunker. It was parked on the street in front of his house when we got there looking for him. We confirmed later it was the only car they owned. With the rain and cold temperatures when we arrived, we couldn't tell if it had been driven recently or not. Although by the time we got there, it would have been hours after the murders were committed. The engine wouldn't have been warm anyway. But we later checked with neighbors, and they told us the car had been there all day and night. Even so, we did check the car's exterior and tires for any trace from the Richards' house. But if he had driven it back there after the murders, the heavy rain would have washed anything like that away. We didn't have a warrant, so the interior of their house was going to have to wait to be searched.
So what was Hawkins' story?
In Decker's mind, he and Lancaster walked into the same interrogation room where they had interviewed Susan Richards. Same mustard-yellow walls, same sort of person sitting in that chair, the accused, a hunted animal looking for a way out.
He knew his rights. He wanted a lawyer. We told him one was on the way, but that if he wanted to answer some questions, it would help us eliminate him as a suspect. But if he didn't, that was okay too. We needed to legally cover our butts.
Did you tell him you had his print at the crime scene?
We were holding that back as a trap. We'd gotten search warrants by then, so another team was tearing his house and car apart looking for any trace, and the gun used in the murder. As you know, they later found it behind a wall in his closet.
Meaning he had to go back home and hide it. And his wife and daughter didn't know about this? How?
Lisa Hawkins was really sick, of course, and slept in another bedroom. The daughter, Mitzi, answered the door, basically in her underwear. She looked like crap, high as a kite on something. She could tell us nothing. We had to go to Mrs. Hawkins' bedroom to see her. She couldn't even get out of bed. She was basically in in-home hospice.
Damn,
said Jameson.
Last thing she needed was for this to drop in her lap.
She was really upset, wanted to know what was going on, but she was making no sense, and I'm not sure she could even process what we were telling her. And her stone daughter couldn't either. Between the two of them, Hawkins could have driven his car through the front door of the house, and I don't think they'd have noticed.
Did Hawkins answer any questions?
The uniforms told him what he was charged with when they arrested him, but no other details. I told him basically what had gone down.
What was his reaction?
Now Decker's mind fully engaged with the memory. He was no longer in the Richards' old home. He was in the interrogation room with the younger Lancaster sitting next to him and the still-living Hawkins across from him. The man was tall and lean, but strongly built before the cancer came to tear him down. His face was ruggedly handsome, and Decker remembered his hands being strong-looking and heavily calloused. They could have easily strangled the life out of a young girl.
Mr. Hawkins, while we're waiting for your PD to be assigned, can you clear up a few points for us? Said Decker. It would be a big help, but you have the right to refuse to answer, just to be clear.
Hawkins settled his arms over his chest and said,
Like what?
Like, where were you tonight between 7 and 9:30 or so?
Hawkins scratched his cheek.
Taking a walk. Been walking all night. Was doing that when your boys picked me up. No law against walking.
In the pouring rain?
Hawkins touched his wet clothes.
And here's the proof. When they picked me up, that's what I was doing. Honest to God.
Where were you walking?
All over. Had to think.
What about?
None of your beeswax, he paused. And hold on, they never told me who was killed.
Lancaster told him who and where.
Hell, I don't know those people.
Decker said casually, so you've never been to that house?
Never. No reason to.
You see anybody on your walk who can corroborate your story?
Nope. It was raining. Nobody was dumb enough to be outside, except me.
You ever been to the American Grill on Franklin Street?
Asked Lancaster.
I don't eat out much. Can't afford it.
You ever run into the owner?
And who's that?
David Katz.
Never heard of him.
Lancaster described him.
Nope, doesn't ring a bell with me.
A far slimmer Ken Finger, Hawkins's court-appointed attorney, arrived just then, and Hawkins was compelled to open his mouth and provide a court-ordered cheek swab of his DNA. Hawkins asked Decker what he was going to do with that sample.
None of your beeswax, Decker replied.
Decker looked at Jameson after describing this back and forth to her.
And later that morning, a search team found the gun hidden behind a loose section of wall in Hawkins's closet. Ballistics matched the bullets taken out at the postmortem.
And the DNA from the cheek swab?
It took a while to get the results back, but they matched the trace under Abigail Richards's fingernails.
Case closed at that point.
Apparently.
Decker looked at the floor again.
Except for no traces from the rain.
He could have had another pair of shoes and socks with him. He could have taken off his shoes and left them outside and changed into the dry shoes.
Decker shook his head.
No.
Why not?
Look at the porch.
Jameson stepped to the window and looked at the small roofed porch with open sides. Decker said,
Mary and I got soaked going in, and that porch offered almost no protection, and I don't see Hawkins having the foresight to bring an extra pair of shoes and socks. And how could he take the time to stop and change out of his shoes before breaking into a house with a bunch of people in it? Anybody could have looked out the front door or window and seen him. And hell, he'd have to have brought another set of clothes and a hairdryer before he set foot inside. Otherwise, there would have been traces.
Is there another way into the house that he could have used?
None that wouldn't leave us with the same problem as now.
He could have cleaned up his wet traces on his way out.
After murdering four people, he's going to take the time to do that? And from all the different places he had to be in the house to kill them all? And there's carpet, too, so he's gonna what, get out a steam cleaner and fire it up and get rid of every single bit of mud, wet gravel, soaked blades of grass?
But, Decker, you know the alternative, if that is the case.
Decker glanced over at her.
Yeah, that Hawkins was right, and I was wrong. He was innocent, and I put him away in prison. And now, he's dead.
That wasn't your fault.
The hell it isn't, said Decker.
Chapter 11. There was no place on earth colder than a morgue. At least Decker was thinking that as he looked down at the body of Merrill Hawkins on the metal table. The ME had drawn back the sheet so that Hawkins's emaciated body was completely exposed. On one side of Decker stood Jameson. On the other was Lancaster. The ME noted,
As I said, the cause of death was a small caliber, soft nose, or dum-dum bullet. It deformed after cleaving through the skull and then cartwheeled through the soft tissue, breaking up more as it did so, just as it's designed to do. He pointed to the man's brain that was sitting on another table. You can see that it did considerable damage. Hawkins would have died instantly. Round was still in the soft tissue. In fragments. That's why I can't give you a more exact answer as to caliber.
And no way to do a ballistics comparison if we do find a gun to test?
Said Lancaster.
Afraid not. As I said, it's just metal slivers and chunks dispersed over a wide area of the brain. Like a bomb exploded. Really, no spiral lands or grooves from the gun barrel left to match it to, unfortunately. He added, There were also traces of polyurethane foam and microbeads embedded in the wound and brain tissue.
What?
Said Jameson, looking puzzled. Decker said, The killer used a pillow to muffle the shot.
Cheap versions of a muzzle suppressor,
added Lancaster.
The burn marks on his forehead would have been even more pronounced if the killer hadn't used the pillow. It was pretty close to a contact wound.
They must have cleaned up the trace and taken the pillow with them, said Decker. There was no sign of it in the room.
Decker pointed to the man's forearms.
They're healed now, of course, but that's where the scratches were, presumably from Abigail Richards trying to fight him off.
Lancaster added,
after he was arrested and jailed, we noted the wounds on his arms. Hawkins said he'd fallen down and scraped both arms. He'd cleaned them up and bandaged them before he was arrested. If any of Abigail Richards' DNA was on him, that probably would have removed it. In fact, we found none. But we did find his DNA on her.
Jameson said,
and that seems to be rock-solid evidence of his guilt. I mean, he was there. She tried to fight him off. He was good for the murders.
Yeah, said Decker. And all we have against that is a guy who said he was innocent, and now he's dead.
Lancaster said,
do you think it could be that Hawkins did commit the murders but wasn't alone? He had an accomplice, and now that accomplice killed him before he could reveal his identity?
He said 13 years to do that, pointed out Decker. And you'd think Hawkins would have fingered an accomplice at his trial, if for no other reason than to cut a deal. And there's something else.
He told Lancaster about his rain theory.
He added, rain residue and other trace from the storm should have been found at the crime scene, but it wasn't.
Lancaster seemed taken aback by this.
I never focused on that.
Neither did I, until now.
Crap, Decker.
Yeah.
What's that on his forearm?
Asked Jameson. The M.E., a short, balding man in his 50s, pulled an overhead lamp on a long flex arm closer and turned it on, hitting that spot.
Yes, I noted that, he said. Let's take a closer look.
The marks on Hawkins's arm were black and dark green and brown. A casual observer might have concluded that they were bruises, only they weren't. Closer inspection under the intense light revealed clearly what they were.
It's a tattoo, said Decker, or several tattoos.
That's what I concluded, too, said the M.E., but poorly done ones. I mean, my daughter has one, and it's far nicer than these.
Decker opined,
but that's because these were done in prison, with very crude instruments and whatever they could find to use as ink.
How do you know it wasn't done before he went to prison?
Asked Jameson.
Because I saw his forearms 13 years ago. Several times. No tats.
Decker leaned down and looked at the marks from a few inches away.
Looks like they used paper clips or maybe staples. That tat looks like they used soot mixed with shampoo for the ink. The other two seem to be styrofoam that's been melted. Those are pretty popular choices for inmate tats.
Didn't know you were such an expert on prison tattoos,
said Jameson.
Decker and I have visited our share of prisons over the years,
noted Lancaster.
Seen a lot of convict skin with body art. Some cool, some hideous.
Decker was still looking at the tat.
It's a spider web.
Trapped,
said Lancaster.
What?
Asked Jameson.
Symbolizes being trapped in prison, explained Decker. It's referring to their prison sentence.
That looks like a teardrop,
observed Jameson, pointing to the mark near the crook of the elbow. Decker nodded.
Right, it is.
What does that mean?
Lancaster and Decker exchanged a glance. He said in a subdued tone,
sometimes it denotes that the person has been raped in prison. Usually it's inked on the face, where everyone can see it.
Damn,
said Jameson. Decker closed his eyes and felt sick to his stomach.
And I helped put you there because maybe I didn't do a thorough enough investigation.
Jameson was watching Decker and put a hand on his arm. His eyes popped open, and he abruptly moved away from her. He didn't notice her hurt look at his reaction. Lancaster examined the last mark that was to the right of the teardrop.
"I've never seen one like that before, though,"
she said.
"Looks like a star with an arrow going through it,"
said Jameson. She looked at Decker.
"Any ideas?"
"Not yet," he replied. He looked at the ME. "How far along was his cancer?"
The ME shuddered. "Advanced. If the bullet didn't get him, my guess is he had a few weeks left. Actually, I'm surprised he was still able to function."
"He said he was on street meds,"
said Jameson. "The tox screens will show what was in his system. He had nothing in his stomach, no food or anything, I mean. I would imagine his appetite would have been negligible at that point, but he must have been a strong man to keep going with that level of cancer in him." Decker said,
"Well, maybe wanting to prove his innocence gave him that strength."
"Anything else of interest?"
asked Lancaster. "We've got his clothes over there in those evidence bags." Lancaster looked at Decker.
"He also had a small duffel. We've got it at the station. Nothing much in it, but you'll probably want to go through it."
Decker nodded as he continued to stare down at the body. Three tats. The spiderweb looked to be the oldest. That made sense. When Hawkins had first got to prison, he was probably pissed beyond belief if he was indeed innocent. The web tat would have been one of his few ways to vocalize that anger. The teardrop tat probably came soon thereafter. Fresh meat in prisons did not remain fresh for long.